So we're going to call to order the meeting of the Senate Committee on Education. Today is February 3rd, 2015, and thank you all for being here. We're going to take care of a little bit of committee business to begin with, and then we have a packed agenda for the rest of the time. So to begin with, I will entertain a motion to adopt the committee rules.
Chair Roblin, I enthusiastically move to adopt the proposed committee rules as presented.
Senator Canope has enthusiastically endorsed the rules for our committee. Is there any discussion? Was that
I'm discussion? Not sure the enthusiasm was appropriate, but we'll go with it. So.
Any objection to the rules? Seeing none, they are adopted. And now I think we can introduce the committee members and the staff, and we'll let people do that as we go along together. Oh, very good. Here we come. So we'll start at this end since we see Senator Bertschinger coming in from the other side late.
Okay. Senator Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1. Not quite new on this committee, so looking forward to another adventure.
Mark Hass from the Beaverton, Alloa, Washington County area. We have some great issues in this committee. This is by far my favorite committee in the entire building. So,
no, that's because you're not on the marijuana committee.
And because you were an outstanding chair for those many years. So thank you. Appreciate that service as well and look forward to watching you in your new role. We'll go back to the we're just introducing ourselves. So.
Oh, I'm Sarah Gelster. I'm the state senator from Corvallis and Albany, Senate District 8.
And we want to thank you for coming to us from the House and for having been in education for a while yourself. So thank you for that. We'll skip over to the far end.
Is that me?
Senator Bertschinger.
Ah, yeah. Well, first of all, it's always an honor to be on one of your committees. Senator Roblin, you've been really good to work with and help me through this process and educate me through this process. And so now you get to educate me on education.
That's it.
And you represent?
Senator, what is that? District 2. Yeah. Southern Oregon.
Okay. I'm Lee Beyer, and I have the pleasure of representing the people of Central Linn and Lane counties, and I'm continuing member of the committee.
Tim Canope. Represent Senate District 27, which includes Bend, Redmond, Sun River, and Tumalo.
Okay. And I am Senator Roblin, District 5, which is pretty much the Oregon coast. I go from Charleston in the south to Tillamook in the north and then into the valley. So a wonderful part of Oregon. And I will allow our new Gretchen Imbring to introduce her staff. So, Gretchen.
I'm Gretchen Imbring. I am the committee administrator, and we have Oksana over here. She'll be our committee assistant.
So with that, I think it's time to get started. And today we're going to, I'll actually open an informational meeting, and it is invited testimony only. We're actually beginning a process to look at the education reforms that have been put in place over the last 4 or 5 years in Oregon and to see how we're doing because in their wisdom a few years ago when OEIB was introduced as a new concept to Oregon, they put a sunset clause and we are coming to that point and so it is the time to really have an in-depth look at OEIB, HEC, and how it's managed. To give the legislature an understanding of where we're going, what we've done, and what the future looks like from the perspective of the people who have been helping us implement those reforms, and to make decisions about whether they get to be take the sunset away, whether we have suggestions from members of the public and others on things and changes and other things that we would like to see, but in general to really have a discussion with the people of Oregon about where we're going to move in this educational reform. And I'm excited because many of those people I have worked with for many years and they are exceptional human beings and care about education a lot. So we get to hear from a group of them today and I'm excited about that. So with that, we'll invite Nancy Golden to come up and bring whichever of the rest of the group you want to have up there with you to begin with in how order because you guys have an idea of how your order should be, so I would rather do that. And so as the Chief Executive Officer of the OEIB, thank you, and make sure that we introduce yourselves as you go forward. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Nancy Golden. I'm the Chief Education Officer, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Education Investment Board. I will be having my colleagues present with me, and you'll be hearing from the Acting Early Learning Director, Megan Irwin, the Deputy Superintendent, Rob Saxton, the Youth Development Director, Iris Bell, and Ben Cannon, the HEC Director, the Executive Director of the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission. Before I get started, I do want to just say that, Senator Roblin, we've had a long history as educators together. I remember when you were principal at their high school in Coos Bay that I helped write a grant that I think we were successful at. So I know your commitment to children, and I really appreciate it, and congratulations on being the chair. So I'm going to be talking about the work of the Oregon Education Investment Board. I'm going to talk about the charge from the legislators, which was to make sure we provide strategic leadership and coordination against the whole public school system, beginning, well, the P to 20, so beginning from birth through college and career. And then I'll ask each of the directors to talk more specifically about their programs. I want to start by talking about a student, and I actually met the student when I was superintendent in Springfield Public Schools. And you might all be aware, if you're an administrator and you see a little guy, and this is either a kindergartner or first grader, walking down the hall without that big key that says, I'm on my way to the bathroom, you know your job is to ask them where he's going so you make sure he's going the right place. So I kneeled down to this little boy, and I said, where are you going? And he said, I'm going to college. So he's going, and it's our job to get him there. And I would say fundamentally, either college or career, that's what the Oregon Education Investment Board is all about. It's creating a seamless system, starting at birth, through college or career to college, whichever way you choose to go, making sure that we focus on the key transitions, we find out what are the outcomes we need, what are the key strategies that we need, and we really make sure that that's seamless for that student as they move along. So the North Star, of course, is the 40-40-20 goal that was developed and supported by the legislators. It was a bipartisan support given by the legislators, and that North Star, I think, is really compelling for a lot of people when I go out and I speak. I think I want to tell you a little bit more about this young man, because the reason he knew he wanted to go to college is that he was part of a program called the No Excuses University. And what you'll see is there's a lot of programs like that now. We have No Excuses University, we have the Dream School, which is at Alter and Reynolds, and we have College Possible. And these are programs that create college-going culture beginning in elementary school. So kids who might be the first in their families to go have a sense of, there's a place I can go to, and I have to work really hard and get the skills I need to go there. I think that's a huge responsibility. If we're helping children have that dream, then I believe it is our responsibility to make sure that we get them to achieve the dream. So what was happening? The reason, one question is, why the OEIB? Why was it created? Well, we were seeing persistent barriers for students. And one example would be students coming to kindergarten. What we would see is some students who were read to every night had a library of books in their bedrooms, and other students who didn't even have one book in their home. And when you think about the difference between the opportunity for each of these children to build that critical vocabulary that launches them successfully on the pathway, that's just one example of a persistent barrier to making sure kids get to career or college. The second thing we saw is a growing opportunity gap. So I think we all have read the research that say some students hear 30 million more words by the age of three, some children, than other children. Now, these aren't, some of the words are repeated. They're not new words. But when you think about the impact that vocabulary has on pre-literacy, on being able to lead, we see that there's an opportunity gap, and we need to take a lead and really making sure we overcome that opportunity gap. The other thing is we saw that parts of the education system were working in silos. So there was early learning, there was K-12, there was community college, and there were higher ed. And not only did we work in isolation, but sometimes transitioning for a child from one part on the system to the other was really difficult. And I want to use a concrete example. Again, when I was superintendent, after we created the 40-40-20 goal and the vision, I think a lot of us in the field started saying, boy, I need to go talk, in my case, to Head Start. I'm embarrassed to tell you I was a superintendent for 10 years, and I must have been 5 or 6 years into it before I ever really went down to Head Start, went to Head Start. So when I was in Head Start, I was shown around by a woman, and I thought she was the principal. She was really knowledgeable, and she showed me the standards that the little kids have. She showed me the portfolio that demonstrates the knowledge, and I'm in there going, well, we should have portfolios in kindergarten in Springfield schools. And I see their standards. Have we really made those standards work with us in the K-12 system? This person also took me in and showed me how they support teachers in their professional development, how right on time they coach them in their learning. Now I'm thinking I want to recruit this administrator to my school district because she seemed to be so effective. It was only later during the visit that I learned that this was actually a parent of a child in the program, and that this parent was so empowered around understanding her child's education. And I have to say, when I think about going into kindergarten, I'm not sure that we had worked with parents that effectively. So I think about that transition for a parent who had so much to do with the program transitioning into a kindergarten program where maybe they didn't receive as much of education around the standards. And it really made me see that I needed to work much more closely with the age three, the grade three. That's fundamentally what part of breaking down those silos. It's learning from each other, but making it seamless for a child and a child's family. So if they feel comfortable in early learning, they need to feel comfortable in K-12 and all the way along the pathway. So those are the three big reasons that I think it was decided when the bill passed that we really needed some coordination through birth, through college, and career. I talked a little bit about what were the core things that the OEIB did, but it really is to lead and coordinate that seamless system of education, to develop core strategies, and we do that by having outcomes on achievement compacts, to figure out what the best practices are and to make sure we scale them up. We need to focus on these transitions, particularly age three, the grade three, 11 through 14. We have to remove barriers for students to get college credits in high school. It's a huge barrier because many children might be the first children in their family to go to college, so they don't even know that they can go to college. And when we give them courses in high school, they really begin to see that they can do it, that it's something they're interested in doing it. And again, of course, financially, it really helps the children get some credit already done in high school, so the cost of college is not that expensive. The other thing, of course, we do is we do make recommendations to the governor's budget and then on to the legislators. So I think a core thing to talk about with the work of the OEIB is to understand that how one point of the system really leverages the next point. So what we know is if we have stable and attached families, that kids are going to come to kindergarten ready to learn. And if they come to kindergarten ready to learn, we know they're going to read proficiently by third grade. And once you read proficiently by third grade, your success of going on to college increases substantially, so that we know completing high school can become a reality. Once you get those courses in high school, we know that you can move on to a career in college or college and career, and that you'll be able to enter post-secondary, whether you're getting a certificate or license or a degree, really ready to be successful in post-secondary. The other thing I think that's really critical when we look at how one area can leverage another area is, and I'm going to use third grade reading because we really do have a major initiative about what we're calling age three to grade three. So I think again about when I was a superintendent, and I think how much, if a child's not reading by third grade, they have 85 to 90% of the students never catch up, never become really strong leaders. So I think as a superintendent, how much money I put into remediation after age of nine, how much the system put into remediation. We had special classes. We had special materials. We brought kids in early. And I think about if we could get them reading at third grade, all the money we could save along the pathway that we could put for all of the things we've had to give up, for more PE classes, for lower class size, for electives, for the arts, for accelerated classes. So hitting these early points are really, really critical, and that's why these key transitions are really so important to all of us. So this is a little bit about the structure. The key piece I want to say about the structure is that what you see is that there's a single point of leadership. That would be me as the chief education officer, who has responsibility to make sure the system is seamless and that children are successful, particularly with transition. It really means that we're reframing our thinking. We're going to think about policy. We're going to think about improvement. We're going to think about investment. And we're going to think of the perspective of P20 as opposed to the silos. The other thing that is really important, we have to be a nimble. We have to think about strategy and being a strategy setting board. And we're not at all meant to be a super board that overburdens other parts of the pathway by micromanaging the entire system. The authority to govern are in the sectors. That's not the job of the Oregon Education Board. It's really to do the things that I've talked about. I think another really important piece of this job is to make sure that when we make strategic investments, that we're evaluating them, that we're working with the legislators to say, this is an investment that really made a difference. We need to scale this up for all of our students, and we need to know that when money is allocated, we use it in a way that's really going to benefit our students. This is just an organizational chart for, in case you're interested.
Sarah, did you have
a... I had a quick question. On the slide before that, why is there an asterisk next to Oregon State University? Does that mean something in particular?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gelser, Ben Cannon, Executive Director for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. That asterisk just betrays the origin of this slide as the summer of 2014, before OSU had actually elected to receive an institutional board. It should be removed now. They are equal to University of Oregon, PSU, and soon the other four institutions that will also have their own institutional boards.
Thank you for the question. So I started to go over this. I think what's really important about this and my responsibility is to make sure that we're doing quality implementation all along the pathway. So that would be early learning, K-12, higher ed and college, into the world of work. So I want to talk a little bit about the achievement compacts and share with you how do the achievement compacts really work as being one of the major things that help us stay focused on outcomes for kids and getting students there. So I want to go back to the little guy that I talked about earlier. I want to talk about how he would move along a pathway focusing on all the outcomes on the achievement compact. So the first outcome is ready for kindergarten. I think the little boy would say, I'm ready. Reading proficiently by third grade, he'd say, I'm a reader, I can read, and now I can read to learn. In fifth and eighth grade, making sure he is proficient in math, the little boy would think algebra 2 is not going to be a barrier. I can get across that barrier, and I can graduate from high school. Sixth and ninth grade, eliminating chronic absenteeism, another measure on the achievement compact. This young man would say, I can read, I can do math, I want to go to school, and I'm going to be 100% attender. Ninth grade on track, what he would say is, now I've got strong academics. I have 6 high school credits after my ninth grade. I have 90% attendance. I'm on track. 3 college credits in high school, which is on the achievement compact. He would say, I can taste it, I love it, and I'm going to college. And that's where we first met this little guy. College affordability, he could say, I've done 1 year of college in high school already. I've done at least 3 college courses. I got a scholarship. I can afford it, and I'm going to do it. And then completion, he would say, I did it. I'm a college graduate. I have a job. I can buy a house. Once I do that, I can stimulate the economy, and we're all going to prosper. So those are the outcomes on the achievement compacts. And as you can see, the achievement compacts are part of our core work. So an example is we've been working all year around third grade reading and how do we start at birth around third grade reading. But I think another thing the OEIB does that's very different than we've done before is how we convene and who we convene. So what started to happen is a lot of people started talking about third grade reading, but the faces of the people talking about it were not the faces of that reflected the children. So I said, we need to bring a diverse group together. It has to reflect our children. We need to have leaders across the state who have been able to meet that critical outcome anywhere from early learning to third grade. And together, we've got to come up with strategies that we know are going to make sure all students are reading by third grade. I'll talk to you later about that. But I think we have a strategy that is really going to move the dial on that. The next thing I want to talk about is the work we do on scaling up really strong programs. So during the 13-15 session, you allocated funds. And what I would say we did with those funds is we really incubated some important ideas that we thought should be scaled up. The people in OEIB were a very small organization, but we have 4 people who work in the research to policy because we know that's important to you. And along with other partners like Ed Northwest, we study our investments to see what's really working and what can be scaled up. So I want to share one with you. This is called the Eastern Promise. The Eastern Promise has worked across K-12 community college and universities to make sure we're accelerating learning and more students are getting college credits in high school. So in 2013-2014, they had over 30,000 credits that students in the Eastern region were able to get in one school year. If students took a credit by proficiency course, and that's how they're set up, then that student had 80% chance of going to college versus what used to be 54%. For students in poverty, they had a 72% chance of going to college compared to 45%. What we saw is for our students of color, we were about doubling the amount of students who were thinking of going on to college. Then we looked at return on investment, which we know is critical. Families saved $1.7 million by getting these credits in high school. And in addition to that, there was the belief is that 7% more kids will be able to complete college because they got more done in high school. They can afford to pay for the rest of it on their own. So this is one project that I think really helped inform accelerated learning, and I have been chairing an accelerating learning committee along with Senator Haas, where we took some of the best thinking from the Eastern Promise. We have it as part of the bill, and we really think not only can students from the areas over in Eastern Oregon benefit, but we can scale this up around the state, and that's partly what we do. That's a big part of what we do on the Oregon Education Investment Board. So I talked a little bit about this. One thing we do is community engagement. I gave you one example. One other example would be with our statewide literacy campaign. We went out and talked to communities. We were all across the state. To parents about if you could help your children learn the pre-literacy skills they need to be one of those children who have heard 30 million more words, what would you want that to look like? And that brought the campaign called Story Time, Every Day, Everywhere. What parents said to us is we're not professional educators. When you use words like pre-literacy, we really don't know what you're asking us to do. But when we talk to them about if you talk to your children, if you play with your children, if you sing to your children, if you tell stories, which are beautiful parts of so many cultures in the state of Oregon, then you're building vocabulary. They all just said, we want to do that. And quite honestly, the campaign has taken off in a way we never imagined, and communities are asking for more and more of support. And we've got business people like Umpqua Bank who are working side by side with us to deliver the sorts of things that will get all kids to kindergarten ready to learn. But another thing we're doing is our community collaboratives. I know you all know about those, but the regional achievement collaboratives are really where people across regions come together to really work on a local level to make sure we have all our kids successfully move from birth through college and career. I had the honor of being on one of those collaboratives when I was superintendent, and we had early learning was represented by United Way. Then we had the superintendents from the big districts and one representing the small, the presidents of the community college and the president of the university. And when I saw the president of University of Oregon and the president of Lane Community College as focused on third grade reading as I was, I knew we were going to really be able to leverage each other of us together to really move kids along the pathway. At my last school board meeting before I left as being superintendent, I received the news that three times as many students from Springfield were going to University of Oregon. I don't believe that would have happened without that collaborative, because we were sending kids up on campus, faculty was coming into our schools, and these collaboratives are really so critical as we think about how are we really going to create this system. We also have the early learning hubs. I know Megan's going to talk about that, but a critical place for our families to go to get the services, to make sure they're stable and they can really support their children. The community care organizations, we've worked side by side with them to make sure children's medical needs are met in addition to their academics needs. So I really do believe these community collaboratives, which we work very closely on, make a really, really big and significant difference. I want to talk a little bit about the equity lens. One of the first pieces of policy we passed was the equity lens. What the equity lens is really about is making sure kids in the opportunity gap get what they need to make sure they can come to kindergarten having the skills to be successful. And so, of course, this really means focusing on starting early. It's a lot of the stuff that I have talked about before. I think another thing that's really critical is as we convene people, we're going to make sure they reflect the children. And what we also know is that we need to focus on closing the opportunity gap, and we think about that. We have great examples throughout the state. We have David Douglas, who has preschools right side by side in their public schools. They're working with the Children Institute and other partners, housing, to make sure they do the kind of wraparound that they need to do for kids inside the opportunity gap. And we make sure our schools have culturally specific practices. So our children need to see books that reflect their cultures. They need to hear about curriculum that also reflects their cultures, and they need to know that everyone's holidays and traditions are really celebrated, and they need to have people in the school who also can communicate with them in the language that they and their families communicate. The other thing, of course, we do, we look at these best practices to make sure we scale those up And we're really addressing poverty through the hubs and working with our CCOs. Another thing I think that's really important is what are the standards that we have to make sure we're going to deliver on the outcomes on the Achievement Compact. So as you know, we've been working really hard. We are a state that has the Common Core State Standards. What the Common Core State Standards did is started with what are the skills you need to be career and college ready, and how do we design those backwards so when students move through the system and they go on to post-secondary, they really have the skills to be successful, to be completers. They don't need to spend time in developmental education because we know when they're spending time there, they're not even getting credit yet to start being able to get degrees or certificates or licenses that they really, really need. Another thing that we've been working very hard on what's an effective assessment system. We know and that over-testing can be a problem, and I've been convening another group, and we've got teachers across the state working on this, the Oregon Education Investment Board, OEA is working on this, ODE is working on this, the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators has been working on this, and soon we'll be going out across the state sharing what we've done to put a much better balance between formative instruction, formative assessment, which really informs instruction. That's what the teacher needs to know every day as they're teaching children to keep the children on track. Interim assessment, which is what you do to say, I might need to regroup kids to get the kids who need to accelerate, the kids who need a little extra boost, a boost, and then that summative assessment at the end. So how do we create a better balance about that? And then the last thing we've been working on is the longitudinal database. We know to really know how students are doing on a seamless pathway, we need a database that talks across the systems that have traditionally been in silos. We need to make sure this data is very easy to access. So that's another thing that we've been working on. One other key part of the Oregon Education Investment Board is to make sure we have quality teachers in front of absolutely every student. We know that a quality teacher is the number one predictor of success for students. And so we're working very hard around the professional development. We've created a network so that people all over the state can be helping other people around the state. One teacher might develop an expertise in math and can share that across the state. We want to be able to do it electronically as well as be able to do it face-to-face if that's the right approach to do that. In addition, we have the Minority Teacher Report, which is a legislative report, and we want to make sure that we have more students who reflect the cultures of the children, and we're working very hard to make sure with our universities to make sure they move through the pipeline, we have more people coming out of programs, and that we're working side by side with K-12 to work on programs that really get us the best educators we can possibly have, and that it's a diverse group of educators. We also look into issues that don't make sense to us. So right now there's over 1,000 educators of color who have not been hired in the state. So we want to know why that is, and we're working on that to really understand that as well. So what we've developed are what we call three pathways. The first one is the pathway to kindergarten readiness and third grade reading. The second one is a pathway to high school and post-secondary completion. And the third one is a pathway connecting education to careers. And I've talked about early learning already. Megan will talk more about it, but we do start in the home with the parents because we know the parents are the first and best teachers of their children, and then we want to make sure we have high-quality daycare in early intervention for children who need extra help. Third grade, we've put together a strategic investment that really says that we're going to have 95% of our children reading at third grade level in 5 years. And the way we're going to do that is first an investment in all-day kindergarten, but not just all-day kindergarten, effective all-day kindergarten. We're going to make sure we use a research-based reading program. We're going to make sure we have partnerships with nonprofits and culturally specific organizations so they can help us create more time for students through summer school, through after school. And we're going to make sure that where teachers are really highly qualified and our school leaders are really leaders who can lead in a way that get the results we need for kids. The second pathway to high school and post-secondary completion, that's really where the accelerated learning opportunities come in big time. We need to make sure that college is affordable. Accelerated learning will help with that. We need to make sure that there is a culture of going to college and all students see themselves as students who, if they choose to go into college, they can, or if they choose to go into the world of work, they have the skills to do so. And we have to make sure that all students complete college. Students are leaving college with a lot of financial responsibility. I think accelerated learning, debt. I think accelerated learning will help that. But the worst thing is when you leave college with debt and you're not a completer. So we have to make sure our students complete so they can move into the world of work. There's some key leverage points to get us there. The first thing is making sure our English language learners are out of English language learners programs by eighth grade. What we show is if they're out by eighth grade, they do exceptionally well in high school. We need to make sure that students have those ninth grade credits so they're on track and their attendance is up, and we need to make sure college courses are taking in high school. The last pathway is the pathway of connecting education to career. What we're very focused on in this pathway is our STEM and CTE careers, or CTE and STEM careers. What we know is many, many students learn best by learning with hands-on curriculum. They learn the theory, and then they apply it immediately. What we also know in many, many of our communities that students can get some career technical education in high school, then go into a community college and easily get a certificate or a license, or move right into the world of work with the skills that they could decide if they wanted to go on later to STEM careers or stay where they are. What we know about STEM is that in addition to this hands-on experience, it really does teach the critical thinking, the problem-solving skills that are so critical for us to compete in this extraordinarily complex world that is technology-dependent in a changing world. So we know that healthcare has a tremendous amount of, we're really connecting with the world of work, so we know where the jobs are. We know healthcare is the area where there's going to be many, many jobs. We can start those programs in high school. We know that high-tech manufacturing is high demand in computer science, so we have to have those career technical programs in high school, and then we need to make sure they seamlessly move us through community college in four-year college, and that when people leave, there's a job waiting for them. What we know is a lot of STEM jobs are being filled from people outside of our state. We want all STEM jobs filled by our Argonians. So that last pathway is going to ensure that students have a pathway from learning to careers and jobs. So that's kind of the overview of what we've been doing with the Oregon Education Investment Board.
Thank you, Nancy.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. So before Rob and Megan and Iris give their presentations, I'm going to spend just a couple of minutes refreshing your memories about changes, the significant changes to the state's higher education structure that have taken place as a result of actions of this committee and the legislature and governor over the last 3.5 years. So this will be familiar to many of you and should move quickly. It's that slide. Yes. So as you'll recall, as you know, we have 17 locally governed community colleges and 7 public universities And until 2013, those public universities were governed by what was originally a state agency, then sort of a somewhat autonomous agency, the State Board of Higher Education and the Oregon University System. At the state level, as of 2011, we gained four separate boards, four separate state boards that had responsibility for higher education. The OEIB, of course, the HEC, which was created in 2011 to coordinate higher education along with the OEIB, the Oregon Student Access Commission, and the State Board of Ed with its responsibilities for community colleges. Most of those entities also had staff at the agency level. So you see OUS and the OSAC, CCWD, and OEIB staff indicated here in the teal bars. I'm going to move really quickly. We can pause for any particular point of this, but I'm going to just essentially jump to where we are today, which is at the state level, really two entities, two boards, the OEIB, working in coordination with the Higher Education Coordinating Commission and its particular focus on higher education, the HEC assuming the responsibilities that the State Board of Ed had for administering funding to community colleges, adopting rules for community colleges, assuming responsibilities for that OSAC had for allocating dollars to students via need-based aid, and assuming responsibility that the State Board of Higher Education held for the state side of our work on the public universities. On the institutional side, of course, we also created a new institutional board. So while we were streamlining and consolidating at the state, we were providing for stronger local links and autonomy for local institutions. So our university's system comes to resemble more closely a community college system where they're autonomous. They're, of course, not locally elected, but they are institutionally governed. The final piece of this, of course, is the as a result of legislation that you worked on quite recently, the four smaller universities will also, as of this summer, have fully operative institutional boards responsible for the governance of our seven public universities. The bonds, if you will, or the connections between the state boards, the OEIB and the HEC, and the institutions expressed through achievement compacts that Nancy has described, and then, of course, we administer a variety of rules and funding responsibilities that help to shape our relationships with those entities. Why do this? Well, coordination and connections on the state, and I've mentioned this already, but putting state responsibilities for our colleges, universities, financial aid in a single agency, ensuring that grades 11 through 14, it says 10 through 14, but we've become more fluent, I think, in the idea of grades 11 through 14 connected via the OEIB and the HEC, and OEIB's and Nancy's leadership in those connections with her and other staff, helping really intersect the silos that might otherwise exist. Streamlining and clarity, I noted the four boards that we had at the state level doing higher education down to really one plus the OEIB and its P20 responsibility, so 4-2, if you will. Clarifying the roles, who's responsible for what, institutions and their boards responsible for the governance, the OEIB and the HEC responsible for coordination and state the deployment of the state responsibilities. A single post-secondary education under the auspices of the HEC, helping to free up resources for teaching and learning. I've been focused on the structure. I'm not going to say a whole lot today about the substance of our work in higher education, knowing that I'll be back, I think, with this committee later this month for a deeper dive around higher ed. But we'll note the commission's priorities around affordability, around completion, around student success. Finally, in a position like this, and I'm new to it, that's focused on higher education, I want to note the temptation or even the likelihood to become fiercely territorial about the sector for which you're responsible. I get to do higher ed, and it would be a natural thing to really lock into the higher ed mindset. And part of what we gain from our interactions with you on an annual basis and my interactions with Nancy and her staff and the OEIB on a weekly or daily basis is being called to attend to the larger P20 enterprise, being called to attend to the key educational outcomes that begin at birth, that are expressed in third grade reading and the other points that Nancy described, and not becoming solely focused on our own sector. And it is a great honor and I think a significant benefit to our work on higher education that we're being really required to think quite deeply about how we integrate and support the work that goes on before students even reach a college or university.
Thank you, Ben. And now?
Megan? We'll wait until Megan up here.
Okay, we'll go with Megan. Okay. We'll hear from Rob in a second.
You're going to stay up, right? Yeah.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, thank you for having me here with you this afternoon. I'm really excited to be here to do a pretty high-level orientation to the state's early learning system. For the record, my name is Megan Irwin, and I'm the acting early learning system director. And today I'm going to do really just two things. Similar to Ben, I anticipate I'll be back to talk in more depth about the substance of our policy work over the last 2 years. So today I'm going to give you an overview of the early learning division structure. We're a relatively new division. Talk a little bit about the work that we do, and then share some information on the high-level strategic initiatives that we've been driving as a division for the last 2 years. So while those of you who have been a part of the legislature for a while have heard about the work to reshape Oregon's early learning system since 2011, it's important to note that the early learning division has only existed as the implementation body for that work since July 2013, when we were established as a formal division as part of the Department of Education. And so here you see our mission: to support all of Oregon's young children and families to learn and to thrive. And per statute, the purpose of our existence is to ensure that children enter school ready to learn. And from that statutory charge, we and our governing body, the Early Learning Council, were also given three very high-level goals. Again, these are in statute, that we're responsible for in our work. And you can see them projected here in front of you. All of our work flows back to these three goals: ensuring that children are ready for school, that they're raised in families that are healthy, stable, and attached, and that our early childhood system is coordinated and well-aligned. And I have to say that I don't think that we would have this clear of a focus strategically or organizationally if it was not for the creation of the Early Learning Council, its work in partnership with the OEIB, and the really clear direction that this legislative body has given us through a series of pieces of legislation around what you expect us to do when it comes to getting kids ready for school. You've given us really clear expectations, particularly around the need to streamline the administration and the coordination of early learning services. And this next slide really highlights why that was so important. So this shows historically what Oregon's early learning programs looked like prior to 2013 and makes it really clear why streamlining was necessary. Prior to 2013, the state's early learning programs were administered by a variety of state agencies and local government agencies, governed by a wide variety of commissions and boards, to the extent that coordinating services, even at the state level, was unbelievably challenging, let alone trying to provide a coordinated and easily accessible experience for families on the ground, which was pretty much impossible. So thanks to a series of important pieces of legislation that were passed in 2011, 2012, and then finally in 2013, the picture today looks pretty different. From a governance perspective, we consolidated four of the commissions and councils mentioned previously into one early learning council that's responsible for directing policy and administration around early learning services in a more cohesive way. And then from an agency perspective, we consolidated the functions and the programs from three separate state agencies into one early learning division, which sits inside the Department of Education, which I think sends a really important message about how highly we value early learning programs and services as educational supports for school readiness. Today, all of the state's core early childhood programs, with the exception of a small handful of about three home visiting programs that are administered by the Public Health Division, are inside the Department of Education. And then simultaneous to this work of restructuring on the education side, I do want to point out that the health authority also created a child well-being team that's run out of the director's office at OHA, and the state's child health director serves as a member of the early learning division's leadership team, so that we're ensuring really close connection between education and health when it comes to services for young children. And then finally, in terms of local coordination, we moved from a system of 36 county commissions on children and families to a network of 16 early learning hubs that function as our state to local partners to coordinate services. I'm going to touch very briefly on the hubs in three or four slides, and I would be happy to come back and do more in depth on them as well. Inside the division, we hold the responsibility for several core functions, and this is just how we're organized. You can see it here. It's for your information. You should have it in your packets, and I'm not going to read it to you. But I do want to point out one thing that we do that I think isn't something that folks that are used to the K-12 frame of education always think about, and that's that our office regulates child care in the state. In addition to regulating child care, we also work with child care providers who are interested in improving the quality of their programs to actually build intentional learning environments. And that's a relatively informal system that isn't always thought of when we talk about public education. So just wanted to make sure that you had knowledge that we are responsible for child care and that about 137,000 children under five experience early learning through a child care facility. This slide is just a quick glimpse at the core services that we provide. Our office administers programs for children from the time they're born until they enter school through a variety of programs that you see here. And again, happy to come back and go more in depth on any of them if that's desired. But for now, this is just for your information. The piece of work that I think has gotten the most attention around early learning in the last couple of years has been the work that we've done at the more strategic level to try to transform the way that the early learning system works. Mm-hmm. And each of the items that you see highlighted on this slide here are key components of that. The early learning hubs are changing the way that services reach families locally and the way that we invest relatively limited funds to have the biggest impact for children who are at risk of entering school not prepared for kindergarten. Our work to connect age 3 to grade 3 is building a really critical bridge between early learning and the K-3 experience, which provides incredibly important continuity in children's learning and development. And it's also starting to offer extended time for learning so that children who are a little bit behind before they start kindergarten have the chance to catch up and hopefully hit that really important third grade reading benchmark. And then finally, we have a strategic focus on equity. We're focused on shifting the way that we invest in our system so that we're focusing on children and families who experience the most disparities before entering school and have the fewest opportunities to access services that might help them. And this is our work and how we see us doing our part to help close the opportunity gap and the achievement gap before it even opens. So all of these initiatives that you see on the slide are able to happen really because of the leadership that's been provided by the Early Learning Council, by Dr. Golden, and by the OEIB. In particular, the focus on the key connection between early learning and K-12 and the focus on ending disparities are especially strong because of the leadership of OEIB. I'm going to focus for my last two slides on the hubs because you're going to hear more about the age 3 to grade 3 connection work from Rob. So just to move quickly into the early learning hubs, the hubs are probably something you've heard a lot about over the last couple of years. And at the simplest level, they're designed to work with us as local coordinators for early learning systems. They were created to make sure that resources and supports become more available, more accessible, and more effective for children and families who have typically been overrepresented in our opportunity gap and underrepresented in our services. They really have four core responsibilities if you distill it down to the simplest level. Their job is to identify the populations of children most at risk of arriving at kindergarten unprepared, to identify the specific needs of those children and families, and then to work across systems, so to work across health, human services, K-12 education, early childhood education, and the private sector to connect those children and families to services that will actually make an impact for them. And then finally, they're responsible for accounting for outcomes collectively across the hub system. And the outcomes that they're responsible for are the same ones that we're responsible for at the state level, trying to create that cohesion between us, though they have a lot of flexibility to decide what kinds of strategies they want to deploy to try to reach those outcomes. And this last piece just shows you where they are. So over the last 18 months, we have developed 14 early learning hubs across the state. The final two are still in progress, but will come under contract with us by the end of the biennium. The two communities that are still working toward becoming hubs are here in Salmon. Our staff is providing them with a lot of support to help them get there. I'll just close by saying that the way that the communities have come together across sectors with a really clear set of strategies focused on goals is incredibly exciting for me to get to see develop. It's pretty inspirational. I had the chance to spend several hours last week with the hub that serves Marion and Polk County and heard actually from a school district superintendent that the capacity and the need to serve young children and families is greater than the capacity of their current resources. And he said, we can't do it alone. We can't do it without leveraging resources from other sectors, and we can't do it without our hub. And I would just close by saying that I think one place where we've seen the hubs get a particularly exciting amount of traction is in partnering with school districts through our Kindergarten Partnership and Innovation Fund. The impact that we're starting to see for students who have been able to participate in those programs is significant. We've been looking at some data on that, and it's pretty exciting. There's also been a wonderful impact for providers. I got an email last week from a child care provider who's participating in a P3 project out east. And as a result of participating in that project with her early learning hub, she's actually decided to go back and finish her bachelor's degree, which she's 14 credits away from. And so in addition to contributing to our early learning goals, we're also helping with that 40-40-20 goal around college completion. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to Rob and just leave you with the thought that I think we're beginning to see that what can be true for both children and professionals who work in early childhood as we make investments in this system are really exciting, and I look forward to digging into that more with you over the course of the session.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair Roble, members of the committee. For the record, Rob Saxton. I'm Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction. And I'm very pleased to be here today to give you a really very high-level overview of the Oregon Department of Education. I'm going to talk a little bit about our mission, our strategic plan, our budget, and then the departments that exist within ODE and some of what each one of those departments do. Before I really take off on that, though, I want to be cognizant of the handoff that I just got from Megan and make sure that as we think about what we're doing in this P-20 system, that the opportunity that we have to work together is really exciting and interesting work for me as an ex-K-12 superintendent. I always used to think in my role as a superintendent that our charge was to start working with children in kindergarten and get them as far as we could along the continuum, especially making sure that they're going to be readers by the end of third grade, and then move them on through high school and then on to higher ed. And now I have this interesting opportunity to exist both between the work that Megan does in early learning and then Ben does with the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, and Nancy really with the OEIB helping us to focus on those key transition points and think about what are the biggest opportunities around leverage to make sure that as students move through the system, that they get a system that makes sense to them every step of the way, and that we're able to leverage the adults that work in the system to coordinate the staff development that they have, the standards that they work toward, the resources that we use in a way that's never been done before in the state of Oregon. And OEIB really brings that focus to us. And so just want to appreciate the work that I do with all of them, and then also with Iris, who's going to take it after I'm done, and the work that she does with the Opportunity Youth, with the Youth Development Division, and just how great it is to work with all of them. So I'll kick it off from here and just talk briefly about the mission at ODE. This is a mission that we've had since 2012, and we worked on this collaboratively within the department and also with many of our partners. The part about this that speaks to me are the words that say that the Department of Education fosters excellence for every learner, and that really the role of the Department of Education is to make sure that we help schools and districts and teachers deliver to learners in the state of Oregon, and that really there's no reason for us to exist if we don't do that and if we're not really good at it. And so it's exciting work, and I'm very glad to be here today. Within, after we finished our mission work in 2012, we set right to work on creating a strategic plan. And in that strategic plan, we set out 5 goals, and they're focused on learners, educators, school districts, communities, and then the department itself. And I just want to talk about a couple of things that are within that strategic plan. We have certainly our goals and our strategies and then a set of tactics that we carry out, but then we also have some really very concrete metrics that we're targeting to work to achieve around a number of different outcomes. One of the outcomes that is most important certainly is the one around learners. And so just a couple of examples of that. The third grade reading target that we have for students, making sure that all students are readers by the end of third grade is one of the metrics that gets a great deal of attention from us. And the plans that we've set so that we are able to accomplish that at a higher level over the past 2 years, and then those that we're going to bring to this group and to others as we move into this session, that I think will really move the dial and get us to 90% to 95% of all third graders reading at grade level by within the next 5 years. And these are very much student outcome goals, whether it's the third grade reading or ninth grade on track or our completer rates here in the state. For educators, we have a number of different goals, certainly around staff development. But one of the things that I want to talk about is the mentoring work that we've been able to do over the past couple of years, where every educator, every new educator in the state of Oregon, in the K-12 arena, both administrators and teachers, have had a mentor to support them as they come into the profession, to help them learn to be really strong in their craft and better at the work that they do, and also to persist. We've lost way too many educators in their first few years of doing the work, and with this mentoring program, we believe that we're stemming that tide and making a real difference in the way that educators go about doing their work. For school districts, there's again a number of different goals, but one of the ones that I'm most proud of is the work that we've been able to do in the area of focus and priority schools, where we identified some schools who were not getting the outcomes that we would hope to see them get with some of their students, and we've been able to come alongside in a support capacity, where we've worked with them on developing plans, being strategic in the work that gets done, implementing best practices, and that we've been able to see really huge improvements in the outcomes that they're currently achieving with students. And then around communities, partnerships that we have with other groups that are really important to us, like our legislators, our nonprofit groups in the state that are focused on education, and the broader community. And then lastly, the Department of Education, where we've set goals to make sure that we're very good internally at the work that we do so that we can support all the rest of this work, that we do wonderful hiring, that we follow a strategic plan and really work that plan to better outcomes for students, where we're doing staff development for all people, but in particular some of our managers, and that we just make ODE a very high-functioning place. So we have a number of customers in the state. This is sort of a list. I don't want to go through the whole list, although it's hard to leave anybody out when I look at it. 197 school districts, 600,000 students, 19 ESDs, 1,200 schools. The broader community, 70,000 educators. They, in the state of Oregon, really, are our customers. And so those are the groups that we work hard to support and change outcomes for. There are our responsibilities in brief. So you heard a little bit about the early learning. You're going to hear about the Youth Development Division. And then we really have sort of five other main components. Our finance department, standards, where we have instructional standards, what it is that we want students to learn, federal accountability, teaching, data and its use, and then the Oregon School for the Deaf. So we operate the Oregon School for the Deaf. When you look at our budget, you would see that 96% of our budget is taken up by these 4 important components. The first is the state school fund, and the state school fund serves all students. The second is the youth corrections and juvenile detention areas, where we provide education for incarcerated youth. Then early intervention, early childhood special education, which we sometimes call EI, ECSE, if you hear those letters ever. And that really is about both identifying youth who have learning challenges and then getting supports to them as quickly as possible, because we know that when we're good at that, the long-term outcomes are greatly improved. And then lastly, state and federal special education programs. I wanted to point out what our budget looks like just real briefly. And there is the current service level budget for 13-15 is an $8.097 billion all fund budget, which of course is a huge amount of money. And you can see that about $6.291 billion of that comes from general fund. And then you'll see a couple other sources are federal funds and federal non-limited funds. There also are lottery funds to the tune of $433 million, and then other non-limited funds, $107 million. So those are the source of resources that we have. Of that money, on the next slide, you'll see that the majority of the resources, specifically grant and aid and the school funding, make up the vast majority of that, and about 1.5% of the funds stay at the Department of Education for operations, and the rest of it goes out through the state school fund, grant and aid to schools, districts, and ESDs. Also, a large portion of our resources come from federal funds, and this is like a really sort of difficult flow chart that I probably should never include into a slide deck like this, but I'll take a quick shot at it. We receive a number of federal funds that come into the state of Oregon and then get distributed into a number of different buckets. So the School for the Deaf, Youth Corrections, Department operations, and then grant and aid, and then the rest of it flows out to other providers that are state agencies, and then schools and school districts, and the DHS and the like. And so those federal funds come into the department. The federal government doesn't send us funds and say just use them however you would like. They have very specific purposes for how they send us those funds, and one of the functions of the department then is to distribute those funds as intended and then make sure that they are used as intended by all the different folks who are at the end users of that flow chart. And so a big piece of work for us is to also go out and monitor what takes place all across the state. And so a number of the employees at the department do that work, go out and monitor for the federal government. What I want you to hear me say, and I think this is really important, that as we do this work, we've taken on a philosophy that we're going to go out and monitor in the area of special ed and Title I and all the different federal funds that we receive. But as we're doing that work to make sure that the funds are used as intended by the federal government, that we're also offering important technical support to districts about evidence-based best practice, high leverage points as they do the work, so that when we are done with the federal monitoring process, they actually have received important support from the state. And it's our goal that when we leave, people will say, we actually know whether or not we're using federal funds correctly. People were nice and friendly, and for the technical assistance that we got, we're going to be better at the work that we do. And we're very specific about that, and I think we've done a nice job of that the last couple of years. So the next slide really depicts where some of the federal resources are used, and I've got to look at the slide to make sure this is the right one. And so if you look at the one that's up here, it says basically that there are three areas that get the majority of the federal funds and whose budgets are largely made up of federal funds. So the Office of Learning and Student Services, which is primarily special education, we have in 15-17, we project that 71% of their budget will be made up of federal resources. And then if you look at the Office of Learning, Instruction, and Standards and Accountability, which is about the Elementary Secondary Education Act and also assessment, that 43.9% of their budget is projected to be federal funds. And then lastly, in the Early Learning Division, you would see that 66.1% of their funds are likely to be federal funds. And now I'll take just a few minutes, if I could, to talk about the different offices that we have at the department. We've made a real concerted effort in keeping student learning at the center of the work that we do, and so we have four subdivisions inside what we call the Office of Learning. And the first of those subdivisions is our instruction and standards component of the Office of Learning. And what you'll see there is that they do very specific kinds of work that are all about outcomes for students. They work on educator effectiveness, use of our state standards, and we have standards in multiple subjects. math, science, English language arts, health, music, and more. And they support our focus in priority schools. I talked about that a little bit, some of our lower performing schools and helping them become higher performing. They do school improvement. They work in the area of talented and gifted students, and then also work on the teacher mentoring grant that I talked about earlier. That's more of the list of the things that they're doing, and I'll move on to the next one, which has to do with our Office of Learning with our focus on equity. And the equity component of our Office of Learning works on students who exist in the achievement gap, who are likely to have achievement gaps largely based on race, and our students of color, and working to close those gaps and offer up districts technical support about evidence-based practices on how to do that. I was speaking with Superintendent of Portland Public, Carol Smith, today, and she was talking about the support that they've received with our group that's been up there working with them and offering some idea, suggestion, and expertise, and the difference that that's been able to make in the program that they run. They've also worked diligently around improving outcomes for English language learners, two-way immersion programs, so having bilingual and two-way immersion programs in the state that really change the outcomes for our ELL students long-term, and then also our migrant students and civil rights. Next in the Office of Learning are our student services, and student services really are about providing service for our students with disabilities. They also work in the area of nutrition, having working on a scale-up process called Response to Intervention, or RTI, which is a methodology that's evidence-based around helping students overcome any kind of learning challenge in reading. And oftentimes we find that at times that program leads to a special ed identification and other times not, right into the general student population, and because students quickly become readers. Early intervention and early childhood special education, Oregon Youth Authority and the education that we provide there, and also our nutrition, student nutrition department. And then, I think there's that's another of the list. And I'm not going through all of them because the lists are too long. And then last, in the Office of Student Learning is Assessment and Accountability. And this group works on our assessment systems, data collection, reports to the U.S. Department of Education. They do training for schools and districts on the effective use of data, work on content standards, and then the assessments that we give to students, currently the OAKS and soon the Smarter Balanced Assessment. Again, some more of their list. And then on to what I would think of more in some ways as our back office function. And this slide talks about our research and data analysis department. I think it says that there are four positions. It's three FTE. It's a huge department within the department with three FTE. And they're working on research and data analysis. Brian Reeder is the person who leads that. I'm sure that many of you have had Brian speak before in front of you before. And his work really is about data analysis, reports, support for school districts, working some with the research department and OEIB and the quality education model. One of the pieces of work recently that Brian did that's been really instructive as we think about supporting ELL students is the recognition through doing some regression analysis that students who have been identified as ELL students that exit high school, that exit ELL status prior to high school, actually graduate at much higher rates than any other subpopulation of students in the state. And it's caused us to really think about this in a different way, and it's exciting work that he's able to deliver to us really from an economist sort of point of view. Next would be the Office of the Deputy Superintendent. That office works to deliver leadership, policy recommendations to the State Board of Education, department operations, communication, strategic initiatives, the strategic plan, human resources, and then also a very important component is the partnership with the nine federally recognized tribes of Oregon. We have our Office of Information Technology, and this group supports all the technology needs that we have around landlines or cell phones and desktop computers at the Department of Education. They also develop software applications that are specific to our needs around education, data collection, and they focused very, very stringently on data security. And then lastly, our Office of Finance, and this is a group that does the state school fund and making sure that all districts and ESDs receive the resources that they're supposed to receive and gives them information about that before they actually get them, as they get them, and then after. That they work on the department itself's budget and make sure that we are using our resource to best effect. They also do fingerprinting, student transportation, and audit support. And so that hopefully provides you with a really brief overview of some of the things that we do at the department. I thank you for your attention, and if I can, I'll pass it on to Iris.
Thank you. You can. Yeah. Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. My name is Iris Bell, and I'm the Director of the Youth Development Division. I'm going to take you through a little history in terms of how we came to be, and then I'm going to tell you about the work that the council has done and sort of end with where we are right now in terms of the work that we're going to be doing into the future. So the Youth Development Council was, the Youth Development Council was actually established in House Bill 4165 back in 2012. And we were established to help support the Oregon Education Investment Board with respect to student success, reducing criminal involvement of youth, and also taking a look at equitable and measurable outcomes for all students that we were charged with supporting. In 2013, in House Bill 3231, we were transferred to the Department of Education. And we were also, during that time period, given a charge by the legislature, by you all, to actually come up with a new investment plan for investing funds out throughout the state for youth throughout the state. Now, that new investment fund was the result of the funds that came out of what many of you know as the old commission system, and Megan kind of alluded to that, that the old commission system, which was based on a youth-based population in terms of looking at the population of youth in a community. That's how the funding was kind of allocated out. And so what we were charged with doing was saying, taking a look at a new way of doing that. And so what we did was we started out and went around the state. We went around the state, and after we were charged, and we visited about over 100, we took part in about 100 different meetings, visited with folks in schools, we visited with the business community, we talked to parents, we spoke with teachers. When we were speaking with teachers, we heard many, many times that the need that they had for services that support kids who had difficulties, social, economic difficulties. We heard from folks about the need for mental health services for young people. Teachers were saying, you know, they could look out into their classrooms and actually see the students that needed help and support. And yet, in many, many communities across the state, there are waiting lines for those services. And so that we heard about that. And when we spoke with parents, the thing that they said most was, were it not for that after-school club, or were it not for that before-school breakfast program, they didn't know what they would do. Those programs have helped maintain stability in communities across the state. And so we hold a debt of service to the community-based organizations that have functioned with those kinds of programs around the state on very meager funding to support young people in terms of their academic achievement, to support them in terms of keeping them in positive environments. They have done that work for us. So in talking with all of these folks and looking at the research and the literature that was out around the country with respect to young people, the council itself decided on an approach that would take a look at two different types of youth. Those youth that were opportunity youth, one more. Those youth that were opportunity youth and those youth that were priority youth. Opportunity youth would be those youth between the ages of 16 and 20 who were neither working nor in school. Now, that is a significant number of folks nationally, and it's a significant number of folks, young folks in our state as well. Nationally, there's about 66% of the kids, well, no, not 66%. Let me make sure I have that data. I want to make sure I give you the right number on that. So nationally, there are about 1 in 7 youth who, no, actually that's state. The state issue is that the state number is 1 in 7. There are 1 in 7 youth in the state of Oregon, 66,000 youth, who are neither working nor in school between the ages of 16 and 20. That's a significant number of young people in our state who are not engaged. And then at the level where we're talking about priority youth, we're talking about those youth who are still in school, who at any moment could become detached from school and end up in that same situation as our opportunity youth. So they're at risk of those behaviors. So the goals that the council were looking at were trying to reconnect opportunity youth and trying to make sure that priority youth stayed on target and stayed in school towards positive outcomes. And so they looked at developing a statewide investment policy strategy based on what community was saying to them about how we would go about supporting the efforts in community to support these young people. So what they did was they looked at a strategy whereby we would have four funding streams. One that would be a youth and community grant. One that would be a youth and innovation grant. One that would look at youth and gangs, because the governor had put in his budget another $1 million to support the activity around gangs that was taking place around the state. And we have gangs taking place around the state, not just in the metropolitan area. So there are gangs taking place, there are gangs activities going on in eastern Oregon, southern Oregon, activities going on up and down the basin communities, and of course activities in the metropolitan area. So that was $1 million that he gave us for that. So we came up with these four funding streams, and we had a federal funding stream as well. So we came up with these four, and we put those together and said, these will be the packages, these will be the funding streams that we use going into the next biennium. So what we did here was we used a collective impact methodology. And we used that methodology because we knew that there were far more community-based organizations out there that we can ever fund. So we required them to come together, these organizations, take a look at a particular area or activity or issue that they wanted to address in their community, and to do it in a collective manner as opposed to trying to fund each and every single individual entity that was out there. We ended up with about 108 applications. We had about 30 reviewers look at those applications, and we ended up funding about 70 programs across the state around these four grant streams. Mm-hmm. Now, we're at the point now where we're looking at our next, in fact, we just sent out our applications for the next funding round. That funding round will take place for the 15-17 biennium. So we'll be working to make sure that as many communities as we can possibly give funds to, we will able to get the funds to this next time around. And so we'll be reporting back on our outcomes around that shortly. This is just a quick shot at our governor's budget for the 13-15 year. You'll see the categories. Most of the funds are going out in special payments to communities to help support the efforts around academic achievement and around the reduction of student risk factors. So. And this, then, is our list of our actual membership on the council. It's a diverse membership that's pretty geographically diverse as well as ethnically diverse as well. So if you have any other questions, I'm happy to answer those for you.
So thank you very much. And you two took over basically the functions that we used to have served by the children and families.
Yeah.
Okay. Because we were very concerned, and I thank you for being here, with the adolescent youth, that somebody would be there to pick up, because we knew we were going to handle early childhood. We weren't so certain at the time what was going to happen with our youth. So
thank you for being here.
Any questions for any of the people that have presented so far? Yes.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. Iris, did you say 66,000
yes.
kids between the ages of 16 and 20?
Mm-hmm. So 1 in 7.
Where do we come up with that number?
That's a number that we got from the census tracts that we took a look at it from around the state in order to come up with that particular number. But we also looked at how they were looking at it from the national perspective, and then we looked at it at how we would look at that at the state perspective, and it came out to be about 1 in 7 youth. We have between the ages of 6 and 20, we have about 740,000 youth in the state. And so when we start to just break that down, when we take a look at the 16 to 20, that's how we got the 66,000.
Okay. Any other questions for this group? And we will be coming back to this. In particular, there's a bill about OEIB and whether we remove the sunset. I expect over the next little while that we'll look at maybe having a group of people probably have a meeting just about the bill, and then if there are people who have real suggestions, we may have a work group at some point to see if there's things we want to change on that. So we'll have that discussion later. I thank you all for being here. And
thank you.
It's a complex system, and it's nice to have your introductions. We have a very, and it's going to have to be a short presentation with respect to chalkboard, because we have another bill that we have to do, so 10 minutes or so if we can get the general gist of. So John, Sue, and Frank want to come up a little bit about some statistical information that I think is going to be helpful for us. And even, yeah, so I'll leave it at that.
Sure, have a cue the PowerPoint. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Sue Hildick. I'm the president of the Chalkboard Project. Thank you for having us. We want to just add our chorus of support for what you just heard from our state leaders around how hard everybody's working to raise the bar statewide. That's Chalkboard's mission, is to improve student achievement across the state. We are an independent nonprofit group. We take an independent point of view. And we are concerned about the national rankings that have been in the news over the last few weeks. And We believe Oregon's performing a little bit better than those rankings are telling the story. And those are pretty damaging lenses for the state. And so we have been working with John and his shop to look beneath the data and to try to understand what they're really reflecting. And we'd like to share that with you today.
All right. And I'll move through this briskly. John Tipponia, president of Echo Northwest, Oregon-based economic consulting firm. So there you have it. A couple of stories that have come out in the last 2 weeks. Generated an awful lot of comments for Oregon Live, and I'm sure in other newspapers across the state of Oregon. So let's start with Education Week. Education Week annually puts out something called Quality Counts. It's an index of a dozen or two dozen different education indicators that they weight in different ways. If you think back, Money Magazine does best places in the United States. Sometimes places in South Dakota end up being the most livable. The Bowl Championship Series does indexes like these in the past that haven't worked out well for the Oregon Ducks. So Betsy Hammond reported on EdWeek this way. Oregon ranks 41st in the nation because it draws lightly on its tax base. Skills have barely improved, so few preschoolers and kindergartners attend full-day programs, and students have fallen dramatically behind those of better-off peers. Low-income students have fallen behind. So three issues in that EdWeek report, if you sort of pull it together, and Betsy got her summary correct in terms of the way they scored us. Number one, stagnant skill growth and growing achievement gaps. Number two, low K-12 spending draws lightly on tax base. And number three, few preschoolers and kindergartners. So I'm just going to dig into their report just to verify this. These are stripped right out of their document. And this first one is this notion of stagnant and growing gaps. And what you have are a number of different indicators where we're looking at the National Assessment for Educational Progress, the national benchmark that is done in every state, and is actually just about to start for 2015 in Oregon this week. And they're looking back into 2003, and they're comparing that period up to 2013, which was the most recent time period that it was conducted. And you can see that on all those change 2003 to 2013 variables, on many of them, we are either last or close to last, which is weighing into their calculations. So this has confused me. And so I dug into this data, and I just want to focus on the bar charts. I went back to the 2003 National Assessment for Educational Progress, and I said, well, what share of Oregonians that were tested that year qualified for free and reduced price lunch? And the answer in the NAEP data was 36% of students were eligible for free and reduced price lunch tested that year in terms of the sample that was drawn by the National Assessment for Educational Progress. By 2013, it was up to 57%. If I go ask that same question to the Department of Education, I said back in 2003, Brian Reeder, what share of people, of students were eligible for free and reduced price lunch? His answer was 46%. Now in 2013, up to 57%. So I'm just going to focus on those two and basically say that, at least as the way I'm looking at it, is it's as if the NAEP came into 2003, drew a sample of Lake Oswego, and then has come back in 2013 and has drawn a more representative sample of the state as a whole, and is then concluding, if you look at that data, that we're not making educational progress. So something that the state needs to pay attention to and certainly connect with Ed Week as we make comparisons back to what appears to be a flawed sample from about a decade ago. Issue number two, low K-12 spending draws lightly on its tax base. Spending on education here, you can see as a percent of state taxable resources, we were rated number 46 in the country. So I dug into that, and I'm sharing a chart here that was produced by the Office of Economic Analysis, and it's the definition of the taxable resources that is going to be driving this discussion. Ed Week is using gross domestic product, and for those of you reading the newspaper and running this state through the legislative branch, paying close attention between the state's economic progress on gross domestic product and other economic indicators like personal income is important because they're growing at very different rates. So you can see this is Oregon's share of U.S. GDP, that bright green line. With computer electronics as a sector in it, our GDP as a state is growing much faster than the U.S. average. A lot of that is driven by Intel and other presence in the Silicon Forest. By contrast, personal income, and if you look at our GDP without that computer electronics sector, much slower growth. So then if you go forward and you say, how is our spending looking, K-12 spending as a share of personal income, pretty similar on the left-hand side, Oregon and the United States. But if you say, how is our K-12 spending look as a share of gross domestic product, because our gross domestic product has been growing so quickly, we fall down to number 46, just like Ed Week said. I did learn just yesterday that Portland, as a metropolitan region, has the 16th highest GDP per capita in the world. So it's a pretty remarkable statistic, and one that is interesting to report on from an economic consulting firm's perspective. Issue number three, a few preschoolers and kindergartners attend full day. That you can see number 48 and number 46. You've got a big proposal in the governor's budget and in the co-chairs, et cetera, and I'm sure you'll have all kinds of hearings about that. So now I'm going to transition. That was Ed Week. Summary, an index with dozens of indicators, and I think the Department of Education, the HEC, and the Early Learning Council can provide better information to you than Ed Week. So I would not weigh too heavily on that. Not long after that, obviously, we get this report from the U.S. Department of Education that says that Oregon has the lowest high school graduation rate in the country. So I decided to take a look at that. These are the statistics that came out just last week with Oregon at about 69%. And so I looked at that and I said, okay, 2013 is this high school graduation rate. If I back up 4 years to 2009 and I look at the National Assessment for Educational Progress and how well kids did on math, those are essentially the same kids. In every state, I would expect there to be some correlation between their ability to do math in eighth grade and their ability to graduate from high school 4 years later. And I found this correlation on the bottom is going across the bottom is how well kids did on eighth grade math. And then going up on the vertical axis is the high school graduation rate. And what you see is Oregon is sort of well off that line. That is, the high school graduation rate that was just reported is quite a bit lower than one would expect given how well the kids performed in eighth grade on the National Assessment of Educational Progress.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you wouldn't mind indulging me for a second. There's been a lot of conversation about the report about Oregon's high school graduation rate and how it relates to everybody else. I think what is getting lost in that conversation far too often is when you look at that chart with all of the states, the numbers that they're reporting, even with the federal cohort data, isn't the same. Take, for instance, Mississippi, that's talking about taking all of their special ed students and making high school graduation requirements individualized, student by student by student. The U.S. Department of Education, if they do that, will allow them to count all of those kids as regular graduates after 4 years. Our rate doesn't compare particularly favorably to Washington, but in Washington, their ELL students and special ed students, they have exceptions to their high school graduation requirements, and even though they are not doing the same things as what is listed as a requirement for a high school graduation, the U.S. Department of Education allows them to list them as regular graduates within 4 years. Oregon, I met with the feds. I sat in the office in Washington, D.C. and asked how they calculated this data. Oregon is an outlier in terms of the integrity of what we report as a four-year completer for a graduation rate. We don't make exceptions for anybody, anywhere. So I think this information is tremendously misleading when we try to compare our kids to others. When you're looking at, you know, 14% of the kids in our state who are in special ed, we aren't allowing any exceptions, and almost everybody else is. The other thing that we lose, I think, when we look at that number is if you look at the chart, we're not comparing to 100%. We're comparing to districts that are, you know, Iowa with the highest rate is close to 90%. So we're not looking at, you know, the size of that gap is a little bit smaller. And we're also not looking at district by district. What are we looking at? In my districts, we're at well over 85%, posting double-digit gains in over 1 year period of time, even if you don't consider now including the modified diplomas. And then the last thing, if you don't mind my indulging, I worry about this conversation so much, because it's important for us to talk about what we need to do better. But the message that we keep sending to the public, and more importantly to our kids, is that somehow their schools don't have a good quality. I was talking to a group of kids the other day. We were playing a trivia game, and one of them gave a wrong answer. And one of these kids, a high school student, said to the other, "I know we all go to public school, but I would expect you to do better." I was mortified that these kids would say this, and that we have created a culture that would allow them to see themselves in such a negative light. When you look at student by student, day by day, what's happening in our classrooms and happening with our teachers are a lot of really high quality experiences. So I hope we can find a way to look at how to make things better, but recognize that the way that we've been talking about high school graduation rates in the state is really sensationalized, and it's not that it's not fair to the schools, it's not fair to our kids, because we're holding them to higher standards than anyone else, and then we're saying they're doing badly because we're doing that.
Senator Gelser, Chair Roblin, you couldn't have made my next two points any clearer than I could. I agree with you 100%. I believe this high school graduation data that has been coming out, it is both new in that every state is trying to calculate it and is coming up against administrative challenges in doing that, but it is precisely, as you say, different standards in different states. There are states up way above the line, like Tennessee, who are graduating 86%, but are starting with kids that in eighth grade are a full year behind Oregon's in terms of their math ability. So I couldn't agree with you more. And just to help you make your case even more, I come to the next couple of slides, which is if I go forward a few years and I say, if I go to the census and I start to ask between the ages of 19 and 21, what share of people in different states would say they hold a high school degree or better? And I wouldn't suspect that Oregonians would be any more or less dishonest than people in other states. And you can see that Oregon falls in the broad middle of this pack. And so then if I take this indicator, these 19 to 21 year olds with high school degrees or higher, and I go back to that NAEP finding and I redo that chart, first of all, the cloud goes away and people are much closer to what you would predict, and Oregon falls right on the line of where you would expect. So the bottom line is here, you've got a new indicator in this high school graduation statistic that is complicated to calculate. Idaho still hasn't figured it out and still hasn't reported it. A couple years ago, Kentucky and Oklahoma were with them. Before that, all kinds of states couldn't do this. So you have an administratively challenging thing to calculate. You have this whole variety of different standards going on, and I would just sort of urge folks to pay attention to that as they look at this particular indicator, because it's not only the kids that are starting to worry about public education, it's businesses as well. I've been in several meetings where business people have said, well, if I'd have known the schools were as bad as they are in Oregon, I wouldn't have started my business here, and that's a problem.
Mr. Chair, that's why we're here. We're concerned about the story. We want to help get it right. And one of the pivots for us, of course, is talking about what works. And a lot of the investments you're making are working, and particularly those around the workforce, teacher quality and principal and leader effectiveness. We want to just very briefly share some of the good news with you, and you know that our work is really to pivot the conversation.
Well, the slides are getting ready. I just want to briefly talk about, I'm Frank Carapello, Vice President of Education Policy for the Chalkboard Project. A investment that you made 2 years ago in the School District Collaboration Fund, briefly talk about some of the results that we're seeing. Three data points that have been very positive, looking briefly at the reach of our work through the School District Collaboration Fund. Looking at measures of student performance as measured by OAKS, for districts that have participated in this work at least 2 years of implementation and beyond, outperforming state averages in both reading and math for most all groups of students. Very briefly, moving on to graduation rates. We are seeing, as John pointed out, performance in these groups of students and all students above the state average by several points. Senator Gelser, several of your districts are in there in group two and group four. Yes, absolutely. Students economically disadvantaged as well, and is underserved races and ethnicities as characterized by the department. A third data point that we wanted to look at was the Oregon TEL data recently, the surveys of all teachers in districts. And what we had in an independent survey firm, DHM, take a look at was the comparison between districts participating in collaboration grants and those that were not. And again, once again, we see that the teachers were reporting much more positively about their experiences in those districts that are participating in collaboration grants. So while this data might not get reported statewide and affect the state average, we also know that there are some things that are working due to the investments that the state has made in the profession and in supporting teachers and schools.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Any last questions? Thank you. And I will say there was one other that I asked them as you're heading off, and it had to do with the F grade that we got for teacher quality. And again, in looking into the data, sometimes when you ask people and they send data, we don't send the complete data. And I think that happened with us in that one. So we need to be more careful about how we answer these questions. We had a bill that we were going to hear today, and it was SB 295, there's a lot of people who are here that were going to testify that bill. We're running out of town, and our time is up right about now.
Correction, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
It's not a bill.
It is a bill. 295. Thank you very much. And it has to do with adding some people to the group of us that get to fill out those wonderful verifications and statements of economic interest, and adding a group of people from the boards that we're having to do. We also had an amendment, and I would ensure you to look at that amendment because we will carry this over to the next meeting. We found that there was one other group in Metro that wanted to add, I think it was Metro, that wanted to add one other person to that group. And since we had a bill that had a relating clause big enough, we decided to write the amendment. So there is a very short amendment that adds one more person to that. And we will have that conversation at the next one as we carry that bill over to the next one. So we're going to close our public hearing. I don't think we need to open anything for the others. And I don't see any other business, so we will close our hearing for today. Thank you.
Are you doing oversights?
Well,
doing what?
Always
Are you doing oversights?
Well, doing what?
You always